ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. I don't care how much money I gotta spend. Got to get back to my baby.
Welcome to Unfrozen Episode 8. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay. And our guest this week, our very first guest, is Eva Hagberg. Thanks for joining, Eva.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Eva, I feel I should add here, is not only someone I've known for like 15 plus years, but is also a multi-hyphenate writer of multiple forthcoming books, which we'll get into. But yeah, writer, thinker, architect, TikToker, someone who TikToks about architecture, which is the new dancing about architecture. But it's wonderful having you, Eva.
Oh, it's so nice to connect in all these different ways over the last. Did you say 50 or 15? Because both are accurate. I want to clarify.
It only feels that way, but 15, actually longer than 15. I was going to say
longer than 15. Yeah.
I know. Well, we'll get into that. We should have some sort of like blood feud and rivalry given that long in architecture world.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that. But Dan, what's on the docket for this week's episode?
On the docket for this week's episode, where we're going to take advantage of the fact that we have a wonderful guest here today and talk about some of the things that she has been writing and thinking extensively about, including a blast from the past from an unfamiliar angle. I'm talking about Eero Saarinen, the architect of the Gateway Arch and the TWA terminal, among various other things. But she's going to tell us, I think, a story that's probably less well told, which is about his partner in life, Aline Lusheim.
Yes. So we were talking before the show and the pre-show in the green room about my book about Eero Saarinen, which I had to clarify is not a book about Eero Saarinen, although Eero is in the title to try and get all the Saarinen fans. But the book is about Aline Lusheim, later Saarinen, who in 1953 was a New York Times associate art critic. She was sent to Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, where Eero Saarinen had a thriving practice. He had won the competition for the St. Louis Arch, the Gateway Arch in 1948. She'd like briefly reported on it. He was married to a very smart, very good sculptor named Lillian Swan. He had two kids, Eric and Susan. He was just like vibing, right? So he's vibing in Michigan, living his life. Aline Lusheim comes to town to report a story for the Sunday New York Times. And as her birthday card to him later indicates, they basically immediately banged. I mean, that's kind of the story. They met, they did an interview, and they hooked up like in the coat closet or something like that. It's a little bit unclear from the letters exactly where they first banged, but they banged. So my book is about the development of their personal and then professional relationship. So he was married to Lily Swan. And he really was an ambitious guy. I mean, he wanted to be a dean at Yale. That was sort of his like primary purpose. He wrote these great letters to his psychiatrist where he was like, you know, I think I could have a different wife who maybe would help me become the dean at Yale. Like my current wife is fine, but I really think I should be with somebody who's a little bit more ambitious, who, you know, can really help me position myself. And, you know, on walks Aline and she starts writing him all these letters saying, pretty explicitly, you know, if you leave your wife and marry me, I can make you famous. I know everybody. I'm a New York Times reporter. I have all these connections. I was just at a party with Philip Johnson. I was just at a party with Nicholas Pevsner. I'm going to write a letter to Edgar Kaufman Jr. and tell him to put you up for a job. So they sort of have this courtship for about a year. He ends up leaving Lily Swan. He ends up marrying Aline. And between 1954 and 1961, when he dies very suddenly, very shockingly, of a brain tumor, she shepherds his career. My argument is sort of twofold. One is that she is an overlooked actor in the development of his career. And two, she was really the first professional architectural publicist. And she sort of codified, set in motion, was part of a larger sort of professional shift around the way publications were handled in the architecture community that now is like how the sausage is made. Like every major firm has a publicist. Every magazine story that you read was in some way, you know, produced by, augmented by, helped by a publicist. And architectural historians do not know this. They just did not know. They were all like, oh, if somebody gets published, it's because they deserved it. And I'm like, well, maybe, but also. So my book is sort of an intimate look at this great love story, and it's also a larger, broader look at PR and architectural PR. So that is the story. I mean, there are many more twists and turns, but that's the sort of basic thrust.
Let's use that to pivot to your other book then, Eva, because that's amazing. Because as you were literally describing this, I'm thinking like, who is the modern version of that in terms of the, you know, if I replace your wife, I can help raise you to new heights. But instead, you have literally written the book on that with Marianella D'April, your other book on basically codifying your architectural PR. And this I want to get into because, yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, I mean, as someone who was a media reporter, as someone who has interacted with PR for years, I couldn't tell you who the architectural PR people are. There's like Liz Cubani, who, of course, you know, long connection with SOM and has her own firm, but still does work for them. But like beyond that, like I couldn't tell you who the power movers and shakers are in architectural PR the way I could tell you in art PR or fashion or, you know, yeah. I mean, all these other industries where there are gatekeepers and powerful people at play. And in architecture, they're relatively invisible. So, what lessons did you distill for aspiring gatekeepers, I guess, in architectural PR then?
So Marianella D'April and I wrote this sort of guide to getting published for architects because we were doing PR for very high-end firms. And we were sort of over dealing with clients. So we were like, what if we just like tell other people how to do this? Unfortunately, I got a new client as a result of writing this book. So my plan for passive income totally backfired. But basically, I think publicists in general make their jobs look a lot harder than they actually are. And that was sort of our motivation, was showing how easy it actually is. So we kind of walk you through the life cycle of a project, right? So, let's say an architect designs a building and they want the building to be in Architectural Digest. I would say, good luck, take a number. Let's say they want it to be in Digest or Elle Decor or the Wall Street Journal or whatever. So basically the guide walks them through how to kind of shepherd a project, how to assess which publication might be right for it. You know, most architects that I talk to, they're like, oh, I don't read magazines. So I'm like, number one, read the magazines. It's not that hard. You just read them, you get a feel for them. To get into Digest, you probably need to have like really great interior design. You need to have a famous client. You need to have a client who's willing to be photographed and named and interviewed. There's sort of these basic like checklists that we do. And then we give an example of how to do a pitch, right? So you send an email to an editor and you say, you're the first person that I'm sending this to. That's really important. And to tie this back to the Aline project. So magazines didn't used to require exclusives. And then in the 1950s, Douglas Haskell, he was the editor of Architectural Forum, really important person in the architecture world. He and Aline start working out what an exclusive might look like. And there's this great letter where he's like, you know, we kind of want to do this thing where you just send us the images and then we publish them. And then you can give other images to other people. But we sort of want to try this thing where we're first. And now being first is the most important thing. So I always tell clients, like, a picture of a building, that is your collateral. That is what you have. So keep it off Instagram. Keep it off social media. Don't just give it away. You keep it. So you pitch it to somebody and you say, here's the image. Here's why the story is so great. We suggest having like two or three fun, you know, sort of angles. You let them know if, you know, the clients are willing to be named and interviewed. And then there's a whole bunch of processes that go from there. I don't want to give it all away, but basically we take you through like what to do if somebody says no, what to do if somebody says yes. You have to think about photography rights. I cannot tell you the number of architects that I've talked to who are like, oh, I bought all the rights. And what they bought was like limited web usage, you know? So it's things like that. It's like, make sure that you don't piss off the photographers. There's now all these, you know, photography licensing agencies like Otto, Esto, they're really pivotal sort of actors in this ecosystem. But basically we wanted to, you know, I don't know if we still say democratize. I mean, we wanted to give more architects broader access to this information, which is pretty much held secret by the like 10, 20, 30, 40 architectural publicists that do work. And I mean, I think not everybody wants to do it. Like, it is still kind of a hike, but we at least wanted to show people, you know, this is how you do it. If you do want to do this in-house, it's not going to take that much time. It doesn't need to be that expensive. Most publicists work on retainer. I work on retainer. I am so expensive. I am ridiculously expensive. So I'm like, you don't have to pay me $1 trillion. You can just pay $195 for this PDF.
I was just going to say the book is still like, you know, Routledge style pricing there at $199. So
it's worth it.
I mean, if you, you know, if you read it in an hour, you're certainly getting your money's worth, you know, on a consultant basis.
People have said, like, oh my God, I didn't realize it was this straightforward. Like, oh my God, this is so clear. This is so useful. You know, because publicists, like, they don't want to be out of a job. So they're like, oh, it's really complicated. And we're like, it's not, it's like, there's a lot of steps, but it's not complicated once you lay it out. So that was our genius business plan.
That actually is genius. I mean, I've been confronted by a lot of these companies that troll around for, you know, photography, copyright violations and the like, and they don't mess around. They are like industrial letter senders.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you've all been keeping up with Shannon Mattern, who's this great professor at the New School, had a copyright troll come after her for using images in a course. And like she had posted to the best of my knowledge, she apparently had posted the course online to make it accessible to her students. And this troll just came after her. So it's really, you got to be careful with photography. I mean, I've had fights with clients where I'm like, okay, if you post that photo, like I am on record saying not to post it. And if you get sued and your reputation tanks, I am not protecting you because I can't. Like, it's one of these things where you can't talk your way out of a copyright violation.
We edit a journal here, and we spent and we have an online presence at the Council on Tall Buildings, and we spend a lot of man hours just trying to find CC images of stuff that we know we can get if we have more time. Yeah. If we get in touch with the right publicists. But we don't have the time, and we can't take the risk of just putting a random photo that we found on the internet of that same building online.
You can't. I know.
Well, it's even worse in many ways. We'll have Sophie on the show at some point, my wife, Sophie Donaldson, who's mutual friends with all of us, to discuss her book project, where she's writing a book for Abrams about sort of the future of kitchens. And it's even more perverse because a lot of these firms, you know, of course, as Eva just completely underscored, the photographers hold the rights. It's extremely complicated. But, you know, but licensing an image for a book is an extremely complicated proposition because it's seen as prestige and forever. And people totally look the other way often when it comes to Instagram because that's sort of seen as ephemeral or whatever. And so really leads to these perverse outcomes. But yeah, the rights, everything is tied up in the rights for sure.
Yeah, I know. I remember my first book, this, picture heavy book called Dark Nostalgia, which came out also 1,000 years ago. I mean, I blew my entire advance on like 7 Ewan Bond photos, you know, and it was just like, I had to, because I had promised that those projects would be in the book, and that was it. And I was willing to do it for, Greg, as you say, the prestige. Like, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have a book. But I paid to produce that book. I mean, I paid for that book. And at the time I was like, I don't know, 17 years old or something. I mean, I did not have $5,000 lying around, but I did it. So
I don't know who the bigger pimp is based on what you just told me. Is it Ewan Bonn or is it Aline?
I mean, Ewan Bonn has a pretty solid lock on, you know, good rates. I mean, he is. But also, I mean, may we all be so bold, right? I mean, I wish I valued myself as much as Ewan Bonn values his work, right? And maybe I'm starting to. I remember
obviously the other lesson there is to have good representation, because I remember finishing my book of trying to quote at the very end. I wanted to quote, I think, like 4 lines from Liz Phair's Stratford on Guy, and made the mistake or just, you know, the good sense to email her Nashville based publishing company that quoted me an insane rate, which I was unwilling to pay for, unlike the insane rate I paid to the J.G. Ballard estate for quoting him in the epigram at the beginning. So
my Aline book, the book is called When Arrow Met His Match. I mean, I had to buy rights from the New York Times to reproduce a couple lines from articles published in like 1953, 54. I mean, that was just like thousands of dollars, you know, but it was like, again, bigger than my advance. But what am I going to do? Like, not publish this book? The people need to know. So
you're right. In the name of truth and decency.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, pivoting again here, let's jump off of architectural exploitation here. I think the big news as of taping this is shop architects are unionizing. I've been caught up with family, so I have not read the story in the Times. I've only seen it on Twitter approximately a million times. But what's the backdrop here, guys? I mean, this is the first major firm to unionize, and it seems like the partners are worried it might introduce a level of rigidity into management. So how's it going over there?
God, that reminds me. Didn't William Shawn at The New Yorker be like, you know, the great thing about The New Yorker is our free-flowing, casual atmosphere. And I would hate to have that destroyed by, you know, the suits at the Union, which is, I mean, I can't believe they're still trying that line, like however many decades later. I mean, Dan, do you know more about the shop unionizing than, I mean, I know what I read and I've known.
No, this is the first I'm hearing of it, actually. So it's breaking news as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. I mean, so per my understanding, a group of employees starting, I think, a while ago, because some of the employees no longer work there who were involved in the union drive. I mean, basically, you know, have a unanimous or not a unanimous, but they have like enough of a vote to unionize and are now, again, per my limited understanding, waiting for voluntary recognition of the union, you know, having signed the union cards. I think to contextualize this, you know, for people who don't know Shop, I mean, Shop is one of these firms that came out of the sort of late 90s Columbia vibe. There's like a whole crop of New York City architects. They all went to school together at Columbia in the late 90s. They learned how to use computers. They were formalists. I think, I don't remember like who was dean, maybe Shumi or something. Yeah, I don't know. Somebody correct me.
Seems about right.
Yeah, I think it was Shumi. So, you know, they were sort of, I mean, I remember meeting Greg Pasquarelli and the Sharples and Kim Holden in like 2003, 2004. They had done a couple of ground up projects, but they were very much like young, upstart, cool, fresh, hot, like, whoa, Shop is amazing. And then like over the last 20 years, they've kind of become one of the, I would say, kind of mainstays of, I mean, they're no KPF or ATIS or, you know, any of the ENIAD, whatever, all these like gigantic, ginormous, they're no SOM in terms of like corporate, you know, like just doing shit. They're not Gensler. I would sort of categorize them with like Diller, Scofidio and Renfro, Piano, Renzo Piano Building Workshop, like known for having interesting style and also doing really big projects. And the reason that I bring that up is Zach Mortis, who's a great landscape architecture writer, made a point on Twitter that having sort of a style forward firm unionize is really important, because the reason that so many people work for such, you know, appalling or work in such appalling labor conditions is the magic of working for a brilliant architect and getting to, you know, change the world through the built environment. And like that rhetoric is kind of going out the window with Shop unionizing. I mean, I think it used to be the prize, like the job itself was the prize. The compensation was not really even on the table, which goes back historically to architecture's kind of early 20th century identity. There's a great book called The Favorite Circle, and it's like architecture was a gentleman's profession. The AIA barred architects from advertising. Like, you weren't allowed to advertise, you weren't allowed to seek work, because it was such a rarefied profession that was just based on like rich people being friends with each other. And that, I think, ethos has kind of continued in firms like Shop, like Diller, Scofidio, Renfro, where you're like, well, you know, I get to work here, I get to pursue my art, and like, thankfully, I have a trust fund. And so workers unionizing is like, yeah, one, we don't have trust funds. Two, our wages are unlivable. Three, there was a thread by a guy who used to work at Shop who, like, his wife was giving birth and Shop was like, you know, his manager at Shop was like, you have to provide these drawings. And he was on his laptop in the hospital room, I guess, like cutting the baby's cord and then going back to like fix some renderings.
And that thread ends with him and like, and then I cut all ties to the firm.
Yeah, which... he was like, and I was like, I don't know why you didn't cut the ties before, but you know, whatever gets you going. But I mean, I just think there has been this culture, you know, up until I think a couple years ago, where it's considered so hard to get a job in architecture. It's even harder to get a job where you do cool buildings. Shop does really cool buildings. The Barclays Center is cool. You know, Greg is cool. There's like a big cool factor. And workers are saying like, yeah, that's actually not enough. You actually need to pay us. So I think this is great. I am like pro these unionizers. I hope everybody follows suit. You know, I think that the rhetoric that like it's going to make things more complicated is so just like, I can't believe anybody is still trying that. That's like what I'm shocked by. Like, really, you're going to try that?
Oh, and I mean, you know, and having worked in small practices that are, you know, cool, including some people who just won the AIA gold medal, you know, I can tell you that Yeah, the inefficiencies do not stem from employee unionization efforts. I mean, it comes from emailing attachments around to a principal and things like that. And it doesn't matter how big or small the firm is. You know, it always starts at the top. Yeah. And, you know, the whole philosophy of like, it's a privilege to be here. You're building your portfolio. You're on your way up. You know, it's true for like 1% of the population who right. make it through, you know, right. like the people who graduate the OMA ringer and then become Jeannie Gang and become BRK Ingalls.
Right. Exactly.
Well, the riff I have off that I'm curious about is, you know, someone was suggesting, you know, will this help stem the defection of women out of the profession entirely after a certain point? And I'm curious about whether that could help. And here's a factoid for you, Eva. I can think of one answer to this, but you know, in the past, we've talked about, Dan and I on the show, about which firms might survive to become corporate. And we should have thought of Shop. Shop perhaps mm-hmm. is the best candidate that go from boutique principals into corporate. Mm-hmm. But like, how many firms are actually headed, not just by women? We have a number of prominent women-led firms now, but led by mothers and having an actual culture mm-hmm. of family and survivable work hours. I can think of one head of a practice who has children. That's my own incomplete personal knowledge. But it still seems like there's, you know, this wasteland. And I'm curious about whether it's parenthood or where that boundary line is where women just disappear from the firms because they just simply can't put up with the culture of misogyny that was, of course, documented by the shitty architecture men list a few years ago and everything else that's entailed as well. But I don't know. Do you think unionization helps that or no, or that needs something more specific?
Yeah. I mean, I can't see how it wouldn't help. So I'm not a labor historian nor a union expert, but just like using as many of my neurons as I can. I mean, I feel like having the bargaining power of a union behind you would make advocating for parental leave for, you know, both parents maybe a little bit easier. I remember I used to represent a firm that was very much cult of personality run by a guy. And there was a big push among the employees to institute family leave. And it was real. It became a crisis in the office. And eventually family leave got pushed through, but it was made clear that like, it was, you know, everybody who supported it was kind of annoying. And then one of the people got pregnant and took family leave. And that was considered like really inappropriate. And, you know, so I think like if you as an individual are facing the choice to have a child and you're like, well, okay, technically I could take leave if I live in New York State, like it's guaranteed to X number of weeks or whatever, but like, you know, I'm probably going to get like low key laid off during a restructuring, you know, because you can't get fired for having a kid, but you can definitely get just like your position eliminated.
Well, I wasn't even thinking so much of parental leave, which of course, you know, is a one-time event, but more the notion of like, can the union break the 100-hour a week work culture of exhausting failure versus success, and can it survive to, you know, to create a livable set of hours for families, and will that survive the first time, like, you know, they lose a major competition or they lose something of this and they get blamed for it in the sense of, you know, well, if we had doubled our workload we would have won the competition kind of thing. That to me is the interesting right. watershed.
Okay, that's thank you for clarifying. I mean, I think that question is really important, and it's like the solution is not only to unionize. I mean, I think like a solution is to start to value architectural production more than it's valued by clients right now, and to like raise fees. I mean, if you think it's like okay, well, why do people work 100 hours a week? Okay, because they're understaffed. Well, why are they understaffed? Because they can't afford to pay full salaries to as many people as they need. Why can't they afford to pay full salaries? Because projects are underfunded. Why are projects underfunded? Maybe because a lot of people see the built environment as like not really a huge priority. I think both of you would know better than I do about like the sort of intricacies of like how projects get funded, et cetera. But it is my, you know, layperson's understanding that like no building is ever well funded. I mean, buildings get value engineered, you know, like part of the design process is like, okay, how do we make it cheaper? So I think that, you know, unions would provide maybe it could let people go on strike, you know, which might get principals to charge higher fees, but then there's always the problem of there's going to be a firm that will charge lower fees. So I think this is why it's like collective organizing is so necessary. Cause if we just all say, okay, we're not going to take less than X amount of money, then that can sort of level the playing field. I think the challenge now is like, okay, maybe Shop unionizes and that's amazing and that's great. But like, then shop has to pay higher salaries, and then some other firm is going to come and be like, oh my God, we'll do this for like $5. So like,
well, you know, and another thought too, like given that these, you know, these are really structural problems that you've outlined well, that obviously will disproportionately affect the smaller firms. You know, and it doesn't, it isn't so much about like, is it or is it not a cult of personality? It's like the whole structure, even the corporate firms have this problem. Maybe the solution is something like the kind of industrial organizing that they do in Europe, where, you know, the group of labor makes, makes a deal with the entire management class of an industry, as opposed to negotiating company by company. I mean, that's kind of like my dream solution for the American labor problem, period. But it's particularly acute in architecture, just because it's got, yeah, you're right. It's perceived as something that's like, it's skilled, but it's not super necessary, like being a lawyer is necessary, but it requires the same level of education, you know, and the dues paying is just as rough. So, you know, if you want people to continue to excel in it and to have a built environment that's worth preserving, then some of those, the labor structure issues have to be dealt with.
Yeah.
You know, it's also interesting to see how it's going to work. You know, the Times coverage of Shop noted the fact that, you know, another sort of white collar industry is unionizing. Obviously, the media is the most prominent there. But I'm curious about whether we'll see or could see, you know, sort of class divide union solidarity. And so I think of this, for example, like the John Deere and Kellogg strikes this fall and winter, which were successful, saw a lot of sort of wildcat actions from truck drivers and train operators and sort of other union industries refusing to sort of break the picket line there. Across the picket line. And I was just thinking, you know, New York has announced a $9.5 billion new terminal for JFK that's going to replace terminals 1, 2, and 3. And you read the press coverage of that, and it announces that it's going to create 10,000 good construction jobs, 6,000 union jobs, and also mentions that, you know, the headline architect is Gensler. And I thought, well, what about the unionized architects? Could we have those too? And, you know, will we see AECOM Tishman, you know, construction workers, you know, strike in solidarity with their architecture brethren? I have a harder time imagining that one, frankly, but raise some interesting questions there about exactly that kind of level of, like, you know, architects being seen as white collar and wealthy because of their education levels, intellectual capital, but sorely lacking in the capital, I guess.
Yeah.
So to take us back to the beginning of the discussion, you know, I want to make sure I get this question in because, you know, first of all, I just want to see, I want to see all this brought to life. I mean, first of all, can we get on the waiting list for your book? Is there like a way to pre-order it?
Oh, 100%. We cannot pre-order it yet, but I think that moment is coming. The tentative publication date is September 26th, 2022. So I think are usually do they open like 6 months before publication? I don't remember.
You would know way better than me.
Do you know from?
I don't remember. It's been 10 years since mine. It's just like all I'm sitting here is thinking books, man. Books take forever.
Books take. I spent 10 years writing this book, at least 10 years. Yeah,
well, they can at least do you the favor of publishing it in a decent amount of time. But of course, I mean, is it the supply chain issues, or I always think it's the reviewers, right? It takes forever to get into the hands of the people who will presumably write the glowing reviews that will make or break your book. But
not if you give it to me. Not if you give it to me, who's, you know, heading up what is now the at least the 55th most popular design podcast in Sweden, according to Metrics.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. I will get you a copy as soon as I can. I know that there will be media copies, which I'll be delighted to send to you for free. And it should be available for pre-order, you know, relatively soon. I have a cover, which is really fun. I saw the cover last week. It's so cool. And I've learned from mistakes and successes of my, first big trade book. So hopefully I'll do a little better now. My editors for the last book said to stay off social media, which I did. And then I didn't sell any copies. So now I'm just staying on social media, and maybe that will work.
That's
better.
Bizarre. Whoever says that now. Weird.
A lot of publishers say this. They're like, stay off social media. Like, don't give it away for free. I'm talking to someone who has a really interesting book coming out called The Urge, which is like a cultural history of addiction. And he was sort of asking me for advice. And I was like, I would just like shitpost on Twitter as much as you can, because it totally works for me.
Yeah. Oh my God, look at Rick Paulus, man. I don't even know what his books are about, but he's created an art form out of shilling his book on random Twitter threads. I mean,
no, you never shill the, I mean, that's the thing is you can't explicitly shill the book too many times because then people are just like, oh my God, you're Rick Paulus. This is so annoying. But you can develop like a little bit of a community, you know, by just sort of like being active. So I don't
know. Okay, well, speaking of that, so then I have to ask this. Given that you're on like the podcast of like, you know, the Washed Old Friends architecture podcast, that's our corner of it. So what was the whole thing about like, you know, architecture Twitter versus architecture Instagram? And what is like the latest cool kids camp? Because I know you're like, you're in the orbit of GuestCrit, which we admire from afar. But again, we are the old Washed Friends and like, you know, GuestCrit is the cool kids, Kate Wagner and coterie of Kevin and all that crew.
Yeah.
But so what was the backstory line there? And explain to our audience in terms of like, I guess sort of like how that social media divide plays out and where the fissures are in, yeah. And like, you know, I mean, because there is this sort of insurgent, I guess is this broader context, this insurgent architectural media complex, like the New York Review of Architecture, which I subscribe to and love and you contribute to. Yeah. But like, yeah, how would you describe like the firmament right now of like the young insurgents versus the architectural establishment in a media and social media context?
Oh, such a great question. So the establishment, I mean, I think like you and I are definitely part of it. You know, we like came up in the early 2000s and it was like Liz Kubani and Andrea Schwann gave us projects by Herzog and de Meuron. And like, that was sort of it. And it was like, we wrote for magazines who paid $1 a word and like, it was fine. And there's sort of this whole new generation of one extremely educated thinkers. So I feel like I am not that smart when I talk to Kevin Rogan and Michael, who I only like, I'm like, what's Michael's last name? I just know him.
Michael Fricando.
Michael Fricando, exactly. So they like read theory for fun and they're very invested in social movements. I mean, I think Marianella is a perfect example of this. Like Marianella, you know, has a master's in architectural history and also worked in a firm and is a, you know, was like on the National Political Committee for the DSA and like really wove together politics and the built environment in a way that like I find incomprehensible because I came up being given a project and then interviewing the architect and basically being like, this is a great project. You know, like I didn't have a critical eye. And this new generation has a really critical take. They're really interested in organizing. They're really interested in labor. The GuestCrit people are really like interested in talking about, I don't know. I went on a couple weeks ago and they were all casually talking about Lefebvre, like Henri Lefebvre. And I was like, I do not, I mean, I know I read
Lefebvre. As you do.
Like what, you know, something about like space. It makes me feel like a boomer because I sort of feel like there is just a way that the media ecosystem works and there's sort of a way that the world works. And I sort of see this generation, I want to be like really careful with what I say here. I really respect everything that they do, obviously. And there's also sort of like a desire to, I think, like reinvent things. And I think the New York Review of Architecture actually is reinventing it in a really, really great way. I mean, the kind of stuff that they publish is really smart. It's really cool. But basically, there's this like younger community of people who I think I'm finally getting to the difference. It's like they are advocating for understanding the built environment as a method of social change. They're like, we are interested in social change and the built environment is a tactic for this like larger strategy of improving the world through sort of political, social, economic means. That is a different vantage point than I was trained in. I was trained in like, look at the individual building, understand the individual building, you know, talk about it. The sort of merits of that are, I think, honestly, highly debatable. And so that's sort of their take. There's a lot of like, there's a lot of memes, there's a lot of jokes. There was this like whole thing where Michael was like, I can't stop thinking about architecture. He tweeted, I can't stop thinking about architecture. And that started like a month of people being like, I can't stop thinking about XYZ related to architecture. So Twitter is like architecture Twitter is very, it's like pretty funny, but also I think oriented towards like serious discourse in a way. It's like shitposting your way into like seriously getting people to join DSA.
That's true. I was going to say, but you know, given that Vitruvius Grind and, you know, bikes and IPAs comes out of that discourse as well, like there's plenty of shitposting going on as well.
I was just about to say, where does the grind fit into this and how long is it going to be before he's outed or before we figure out who he or she is?
Oh, the hustle architect. I have tried I don't know who the Essel. Yeah, so Vitruvius Ryan is the Hustle
Architect. It's a moot question. The Hustle Architect is real. This is how Twitter was supposed to be, is that we would actually have, you know, sock puppets and AI characters. I mean, you know, President Richard M. Nixon is my favorite person on Twitter right now. I love the fact that he continues to post from beyond the grave. Like, Vitruvius Ryan, we should protect and honor him, I think.
Greg just muted himself in excitement, I think.
Sorry, I muted myself halfway through. I know this happens, you're too quick on the button. I would say we should honor and protect Vitruvius Grind, like not try to out him. Like I hope his secret lasts.
Yeah, Vitruvius Grind's holiday advent calendar eBay thing was brilliant. I was like bidding on this tote bag on the plane next to my partner, who's looking over as I raise my bid from like $400 to $470 to like $600. And finally, he was just like, we have a very non-interventionist relationship. And he was just like, babe, what are you doing? I was like, no, it's like a whole, I'm like explaining the Hustle Architect to him. He went on he watched the guest stream that I did with the Hustle Architect. And he was like, who is that guy that was an avatar with a voice modulator? And I'm like trying to explain architecture Twitter. And finally he was like, I'm so happy you're happy. Like, you know, so that's architecture Twitter. And I think like what distinguishes architecture Twitter from architecture Instagram is a sincerity, is an underlying sincerity. Like Kate Wagner legitimately wants people's lives to be better. Kevin Rogan legitimately wants people's lives to be better. On the Instagram side, you have, I would say probably the main meme account is Dank Lloyd Wright. Who sort of emerged out of, you know, seemingly nowhere, I don't know, a couple months ago.
Say that he emerged from Smoke Park. Thank you very much. That is free.
Wait, what?
Dank Lloyd Wright. I'm going to say he emerged from Smoke Park.
That's amazing. So Dank Lloyd Wright got really big with a Center for Ants thing. They did, you know, in Zoolander, there's a famous scene in Zoolander where Derek Zoolander goes to look at a model building and the model is, of course, like a, you know, whatever architecture scale. And he says, what is this, a center for ants? It needs to be at least 3 times as big, which I just wanted.
It's one of my favorite movies in the world, not just for that joke.
I will watch Zoolander anytime it is on, like no matter what. So Dank Lloyd Wright does this, you know, they do this whole thing about how they're like the director of research at Center for Ants. Everybody thinks that it's this theorist named Ryan Skevnicki. You know, we don't know, not confirmed. And then I think like the architecture, I think it was about the architecture lobby, which is this group of architectural workers who, you know, I think were helpful to shop in their union efforts. I'm not sure. But like the lobby is basically like, hey, let's unionize architecture. I think there was some beef between the lobby and Architecture Instagram. I don't know exactly what happened. I don't have like the cool payoff. People should know, like, I don't actually have a great reveal here, but there's some drama. And I think it's because Architecture Instagram, Dank Lloyd Wright seems to be motivated. This is just my opinion. Seems to be motivated by just being like as funny as possible. A very worthy goal. But
I think that's fair. Yeah, that seems to be a fair characterization based on what I've seen.
Is not motivated through, you know, by the sort of undercurrent of like deep sincerity that architecture Twitter is. And so I think it's just like a very profound sort of philosophical existential difference of like why they are making quote unquote content. There's also these sort of other, like Boys Firm is another meme account. I think I sort of like Boys Firm more than I like Dank Lloyd Wright, because I think Boys Firm is speaking to a lot of issues about like gender, and equality and gender and inequality in the profession. But also sometimes they're just shitposting. But yeah, there was a big, like, I think Boys Firm listed the members of Architecture Twitter on an Instagram post. And all I cared about was that I was included in that list. So, you know, now I'm pro Architecture Instagram, as my grandmother says, I like anybody who pays attention to me. So that's kind of where it's at. But I think, so I don't know. I don't know where it's going to go. I mean, I think that, you know, I think Ryan Skevnicki does really interesting work on memes and on sort of like new ways of approaching architectural discourse. I mean, Greg, like, I don't know your perspective, but I feel like in the early 2000s, I told people that I wrote about architecture and uniformly the response was like, what is that? How is that a job? What even is architecture? It doesn't matter. And now, you know, so many people care about architecture, care about the built environment, are enthusiasts, are listening to podcasts, are making podcasts. So I think like overall, you know, it's just amazing. I mean, I'm sort of like a booster of anything that gets anybody to think about the built environment, because I've always thought it was deeply important and felt like I was like struggling upstream for so long, being like, hey, you know, if you look around, like the way that you look, the way that you feel might be influenced by what is around you. And people were like, that doesn't seem right. And now it's like, that's just.
Yeah, well, I say most of the people who embrace that attitude now are like all the crazy trad accounts. There, basically, like look at what they've taken from us, you know.
Oh my god!
God bless Mayor Michelle Wu in Boston, like the first mayor in generations who's actually been a fan of the of the building she occupies and others. But yeah, watching, of course, you know, yeah, all the people who seem to be the most into how our buildings shape us are all the crypto racist trad accounts that are out there.
Yeah, I mean, those are awful. What is it? We used to be a country. That's the
Yeah, that whole riff too. That was a great Twitter riff. Yeah.
Oh my god.
Oh god.
Well, I before we get deep into that, I said the most interesting thread, or the one I want to pull out and weave it back into, we'll weave it back into both sincerity and institutional trash fires as a theme.
Nice.
Is the fact that, you know, yeah, that theme of sincerity strikes me as running through, and this is of course, you know, Dan and I are big recreational fans of the Venice Architecture Biennale. So I thought it was really interesting that the new curator was already announced. Obviously, it's coming up fast. And it's Leslie, I don't know if it's Loco or Loco. It would be Loco, according to my Midwest upbringing, L-O-K-K-O.
Right.
And I thought it was really interesting. Number one, she continues the trend, it would appear on paper and based on her statements and her work of, you know, since the 2016 Alejandra Aravena and then Grafton and then Hashim Sarkis and now her of away from the Aaron Betsky form is everything towards like, yeah, how do we solve the world through the built environment? So I think it's interesting that theme continues to be ascended through like the most institutional establishment biennale. And then the second one, of course, is that, you know, she was the one who resigned from CCNY under duress and basically, you know, alleged claims of, you know, all sorts of weaponized Zoom racism against her as well, too. So it was interesting that, you know, that basically the establishment sort of pushed her out and to see her back as a juror who selected Sarkis, I guess, in 2020 and 2021, now rising to be the first Black woman curator of the Biennale. So very interesting.
Yeah, that is definitely a turn from the arch to the sincere. I mean, if you think that, you know, like Kulhas was doing drop ceilings, you know, in 2014 or whatever it was to this, that's quite a turn in very little time.
Yeah. Well, Greg, I think the last normal thing that we, quote unquote, normal thing that we did was we went to go see Rem Koolhaas's Countryside, the Future exhibition at the Guggenheim, which was like, felt to me like such a relic of a time and a approach that was just completely done.
I remember that was fun to attend in several respects. One, which in retrospect, sitting underground with several hundred people in poorly ventilated room in February 20th, 2020, probably not the best idea we could have all done then, but who knew? We all knew it was all coming. But I remember you and I had that conversation with Ian Vollner then about, you know, have we just gotten old or has this gotten kind of like played out? Like is nihilism, can we really do playful nihilism anymore?
And yeah.
I think we went back and forth at the time, but I mean, maybe it was both. Honestly, I feel like, yeah, that, you know, ironic nihilism is not really a viable form. There's no underbrush to be cleared away, to be built upon, you know, so you could build new things. Like it's time to build the new things.
Right.
So yeah, I don't know.
I'm changing this. I'm returning to the subject one more time just to make sure that I do ask it, because it's my Us Weekly question that, you know, has been leading up to this whole thing, which is who would play Aline and Lillian and Arrow in the movie? Given that we've supposedly someone has cast Ralph Fiennes and Elizabeth Debicki as Mies van der Rohe and Edith Farnsworth.
Oh my gosh. Of course. Okay. So Aline, let's see. We need somebody who is very, very confident, who is very like, I mean, she was a divorced mother of two, just like living it up in New York in the early 50s. So we need, and like, just not afraid to tell Arrow that he shouldn't worry. She had thousands and thousands of lovers. Like, she was like, if this doesn't work out, I'm fine. I mean, like, direct quote, I have thousands and thousands of lovers. So it needs to be somebody who's just like, you know, no, I mean, you know who I think could be Sydney Sweeney, who is on Euphoria.
Oh, wow. She's pretty young, though.
I know, that's the problem. But isn't it like the joke that like 23-year-olds play the moms of like 15-year-olds in Hollywood?
Well, it is. But how old was she at the time? How old was Aline at the time?
She was in her 40s. So she was...
Okay.
No, right, 30s.
So I'm going to suggest Cate Blanchett then. Yeah. How about Cate Blanchett? I'm thinking of Nightmare Alley is out right now. But, you know, that's sort of a conniver, you know, is sort of her role in
or, that. Frances McDormand, Catherine Keener?
I like where you're going, but I think Aline was more, I mean, she was conniving, but in service again of this, like, I mean, she just loved Arrow so much. So I think she like weaponized her ability to be conniving professionally because she just had this like deep personal love for Arrow. Like she just thought he was so great and she just like loved his architecture. So I think that like these examples are good, but they're a little bit too, I don't know. I think it needs to be somebody who just has like a deep core of like pure longing in them, which I don't know that Catherine Keener does, although I love Catherine. I mean, everybody that you've said I love. Let's come back to this. Let's think about who could play Arrow. So, I mean, Arrow is totally an operator. I don't want to overcast Ralph Fiennes, but we could.
We totally could.
We could do... let's see. We can't
like Finnish, you know, like he has to sort of have a sort of Nordic.
Yeah, Alexander Skarsgård.
Yeah, Skarsgård.
Yeah, he would be good. I mean, Arrow wasn't what somebody would call "quote unquote" conventionally attractive. Although Aline did say at one point, I guess somebody criticized him, and she said, "You don't have short legs. I would never have made love to a man with short legs." So that's what I'm saying. Like her letters are so sweet.
The things you don't worry about as a man, and now I will.
Yeah, right. I know exactly. But it would need to be somebody who's very intense and driven. I mean, like Clive Owen, if he was blonde, which he's not. Mm-hmm. God, I'm not good at this casting.
Yeah, probably. I think the Skarsgård is going in the right direction.
Skarsgård is the right direction.
Yeah. Rutger Hauer's dead, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
With digital technology, we could digitally de-age Rutger Hauer and put back.
I think he's a little too like. He's too much of a street brawler.
No one could do Aline as Emily Blunt, I think.
I could get behind that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what about the Jousted or Lillian Swan?
Lily Swan. That could maybe be a Catherine Keener. I think that's... Yeah. Yeah. I think we got it.
Yeah, we got it. Yes. Now we just have to figure out who's going to direct and we're good.
Exactly.
Have you sold the film rights, Eva?
If there's one thing... No, I have not sold the movie rights. They are available. If there's one thing we know about Hollywood, it's that if you take a meeting, it happens. I remember when How to Be Loved came out. I like was in LA and I had a meeting with a producer and they were like, so who's going to play you? And I was like,
I would say, given the exponentially expanding rate of Netflix's stock price, like sooner or later, all IP will be absorbed across its event horizon. So don't count yourself out.
You know, the feud that you were talking about between, well, maybe it's not even a feud, but the platform rivalry that you're talking about between Twitter and Instagram for architecture. I'm trying to think of what the analog would be the last time that architecture was really ideological in a societal sense, like, you know, Archigram and Super Studio, like what would the analog be? Or is there one?
The analog to Twitter and Instagram or the analog to Super Studio?
Well, I guess just the idea of like, okay, well the platform, like for example, what Archigram would do would do these, you know, fantastical designs that were themselves commentary. And so they use the media of architecture to do their commentary. Whereas you look at something like Twitter and it's all verbal. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm trying to think of what the if there was a verbal parallel in the 60s and 70s that we could compare to Twitter if Archigram is Instagram. Right. Maybe that's just facile. I don't know.
No, it's not facile, but I think that's very... I mean, I think like what Twitter does actually had no... there's no corollary because it's such like a strange mode of discourse. I mean, I'm thinking like letters, you know, I mean, I used to like refer to the book as like, you know, sexting through the centuries because basically Aline and Arrow were sexting, but through letters. So, I mean, I'm really interested in correspondence and maybe you know, one of the things that we don't do anymore because we're tweeting and texting is like write long letters to each other. So one of the things that I loved in the archives was getting to just see how much daily correspondence there was between people, and they were working things out collectively. I mean, my sort of example about Aline Lucheim Saarinen and Dave, Douglas Haskell, the editor. Yeah. Like, oh my God. You know, they were collectively working out this new way of doing exclusives. I think similarly to the way in which we sort of work ideas out on Twitter collectively. I think maybe that is an analog, but it was like private, you know, it was like private correspondence. Although professional correspondence is interesting to me because it isn't private, right? It's often dictated by somebody else in the office. It is read by somebody else in the office. It sort of does become a collective document. So, I mean, this is sort of a, yeah, I mean, I don't want to stake my career on this being the answer to your very, very good question, but I think that there is something interesting in the way in which sort of this intellectual class, for want of a better term, does like to work things out as collectively as possible through words. And one of the sort of main theoretical interventions that I was making, that I am making with my book, is to argue for the role of narrative and the role of the verbal in producing the built environment, sort of re-articulating how important words actually are, and sort of trying to undo the kind of primacy of the image, where it's like, well, this building exists only as an image. I'm saying, no, it exists as these early conversations before it was designed. You know, I look a lot at the relationship between Arrow's sketches and Aline's words and how her words actually changed the way in which the sketches were developed. So I think that language has always been really important. I don't think that Twitter is particularly new in that way. It's just public.
Well, this really reinforces my argument that when I was a TA, you know, to these undergraduate students in architecture school, like, you know, words are actually important. Being able to accurately describe your designs is really, really important.
Yeah.
And hopefully there's something about this discourse that brings that back into the, you know, the front page, as it were, to use an antiquated term,
right.
You know, for students today. Well, Eva, I just want to thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for inviting me. You both ask such good questions. You're so smart. I'm like sitting here like, okay, keep up. So.
Well, there's a whole parallel conversation we never got into, that all three of us are journalists and two of you are also trained as architects. I'm the dilettante there, but like we, you know, there's a whole meta conversation to be had there about being writers and caring about architecture at the same time. So
for next time.
Yeah.
I say do both and do both with vigor.
Yes.
Onwards and upwards, guys.
All right. See you guys in 2022.
Can't wait. Oh my goodness.
Thanks. All right. Good luck. Happy New Year. Lights, little peeping lights.